and Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ecology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff. I'll be with you for the next hour on this June the 16th on the West Coast, 10 p.m. On the East Coast, it's already past 1 a.m. on the 17th, just so you can synchronize your calendar with the show. So nice to have you with us at the beginning of this week. It's nice to be back after a few days off. We had a harrowing experience at the end of last week. If you were tuning into the show, you will have noticed that Thursday and Friday we were off the air. We had a fire situation in the neighborhood of our network home site, our studios, and as a result of that, the Paradise, California area was under siege. Hello, I'm hearing my guest. I'm not ready to bring my guest on yet. Engineers, if you can help me out there. Wanted to point out that we were off the air basically throughout the weekend, and I think we came on sometime in the middle of the day on Sunday, yesterday, and then we went off again, and then finally got back on the air. So as we understand it, everybody to do with our network is safe and sound. A lot of people were praying. It seems to always happen when the truth is coming out. And Lord knows who started this fire. I'm sure eventually they'll be found out. But in the meantime, what's most important are the lives of those people who had to flee their homes. And I understand that dozens of homes were destroyed. It's the little bit that was reported about this catastrophe in the media. All right, moving along to other things. We are hearing nonstop political spin about the qualifications of the two standing presidential candidates. Standing is a word I use with great reservation. And tonight's topic is actually going to have something to do with some past presidents who were not and are not who they say they are. Unfortunately, history is written by the victors, as they say, and in this case, the losers were the victors. And I wrote an article, about a year and 2 months ago, came out April 19th of 2007 in the Idaho Observer. And it was about the New York bankers and how they infiltrated our government in the late 1800s and moving into the early 1900s, long before the Federal Reserve Act was put into place. And so we had government officials way back then who were obviously compromised and bribed, maybe even threatened, to permit these international banking cartels to move into our country and basically take over our government by controlling the finances. Contrary to what's dictated in the Constitution, the only government entity that has the power to create currency is the U.S. Treasury, and yet that was clandestinely, that authority was given to the Federal Reserve, an international corporation. Has nothing to do with the federal government other than their partners in crime. Now, in addition to that, I did some research on Nikola Tesla, the world-renowned and probably universally renowned scientist of the late 1800s and the first half of the 20th century. He's a man that had well over 700 inventions patented, not to mention those that were stolen. Most of them were given to foreign countries, Russia, England, Germany, and the Nazis got their hands on everything they possibly could. And then I got into some research about some German social programs that came under Circuit Chautauqua. And they traveled around the United States for a number of years, basically indoctrinating people on how to live in a socialist society, including German oompa music for entertainment, and orators from all over the world, and certain religious figures. I would call them tent preachers or tent barkers. And this was a way that the Nazis infiltrated our country before World War One and in between World War One and World War Two. And in the midst of that time, probably about 7 years before the end of World War II, at least, we were infiltrated by a family that came from Germany and eventually founded the CIA, where they were very closely related or associated with Nikola Tesla, the scientist I just mentioned. And they became one of them became the head of the CIA and eventually the 41st president of the United States. Now, tonight's guest picked up on this research, found it, according to him, fascinating, and he realized how much research had gone into uncovering this article. Of course, my research was coupled with some new revelations that were described as deathbed confessions of former SS Nazi commando assassin Hitler bodyguard Otto Skorzeny, who was also, he claimed, a co-founder of the CIA, with George Herbert Walker Bush, otherwise known as George H. Scherf Jr. And our guest and I talked quite at length and examined photos. We examined Eric Berman's photos that he had gotten from Otto Skorzeny. And although Eric had written a book, it wasn't widely available. Many people hadn't heard about it. He had done a few radio interviews. And I found that I could take the information he had provided through his interviews with Otto Skorzeny, whose daughter he was dating as late as 1999. And contrary to history, Skorzeny did not die in 1975 in Madrid, Spain, but died in Boynton Beach, Florida, on December 31st, 1999. And I can tell you that I have spoken with his son recently, and his son is very much alive, living under the alias that Skorzeny lived under. These guys are called spooks in the business. In the intelligence agency business, they're called spooks. They kill them and they bring them back to life working for the other side. What they did through Operation Paperclip is infiltrate our country, infiltrate our intelligence agencies, and we are suffering the consequences of that today. And our guest and I felt it was appropriate to bring this up because the Three Stooges, now reduced to two, but we're not going to count out the third one, who I've been writing about in the Idaho Observer, and we're speaking about McCain, Obama, and Clinton, are cut from the same type of cloth that the Bush family is. And I'm little by little exposing this in the Idaho Observer. And tonight's guest is very, very well educated on these matters, and he himself has written some articles and done some fantastic photographic comparisons of all of these people. And with that, I would like to bring on tonight's guest, a good friend of mine. He's a researcher. He's got one of the most popular research websites in the world, educate-yourself.org. And he's also a good friend, Mr. Ken Adachi. Ken, good evening. Welcome to Evident Footprints. Hello, Ken. Did we lose him? Well, for some reason, I'm not hearing our guest. So we'll try one more time. Ken, are you there? Well, it doesn't sound like he's hearing me. If I can get my engineer to try to make contact with Ken Adachi, I would appreciate it. In the meantime...
Can you hear me okay, Don?
Yes, now I can hear you.
Can you hear me, Don?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me? Okay, Seth, okay, Ken is not hearing me. That's the problem.
Okay, now I'm hearing you.
Okay, I introduced you. Welcome to the show.
Okay, I'll thank you. I'll tell you what I was doing. I'll have to apologize. I lost your audio completely there when I was on hold, and I heard nothing, so I thought maybe the control folks could hear me if I wanted to somehow make them aware of the fact that I had lost your audio. And I'll tell you something funny. I was simply sitting here. I had the headphones from my computer in one ear, and I had the hand receiver in my other. So I know there is a delay between the real time and the signal that it went out. So anyway, we're back. We're back up. So thank you for that very kind introduction, Don. And it's a delight to be with you once again.
It's nice to have you back. Now, I was talking about some of the photo analysis that you did on the, let's call them the Nazi photos that that we've come into possession of in the last year or so.
Yep.
The Bush photos. Then you did a very detailed study on the Martin Bormann photos. It was very interesting, and I know you wanted to talk about all of these topics, and I think it's appropriate for us to talk about them anyway.
Yes, the photo of probably of greatest significance out of the entire collection, which Eric Berman obtained from Otto Skorzeny. They're all important photos, to be sure, and we'll review in the course of this conversation. Who were in those photos and the occasions that the photos represented. But what I feel is probably the most important photo of all is the one that you used on the top of your article, which you published in April of 2007, talking about the deathbed confessions of Otto Skorzeny. And it's the photo that you and I in talking about it, sort of had dubbed the Lodge photo, the 1938 Lodge photo. That's simply a name that we gave to it because it appears, from the photo, it looks like the photo is taken inside of what would look like an alpine lodge. There's wood paneling. It just has that kind of cottagey appearance to it. So you and I had to put a name on it, so we just called it the Lodge photo. And we have to also remind ourselves that we're guessing at the date of 1938. It might have originally come from Eric Berman, I'm not sure, but so the date is not absolutely set in stone, but it's likely around the time of 1938, maybe 1937. And in that photo, what makes it an extremely important photo, probably the most important photo of the century, is that it shows a group of people in sort of a family get-together type occasion. They're posing for the camera. It's who's in the photo that makes the photo so explosive. Because around the periphery of the room are sitting people who later became very top echelon players of the Third Reich. When you see the photo, you can see the photo on my website. You have the story on your website. I just recently brought this photo to the attention of Jeff Rentz, and I indicated that I did a photo comparison between the people in the 1938 German Lodge photo and another photo made of the Prescott Bush family in 1949, and I brought it to Jeff Rentz's attention that look at the folks, the three people in both of these photos, and ask yourself, are they the same person? So that's the photo we're talking about. And in the middle of that floor is a young boy, 14, 15 years old. He's wearing a German Navy seaman's uniform. And squatting down next to him on the floor is a man who we believe is his father. And in front of the father, I think at least, is the woman who I believe is the mother. Based on what Otto Skorzeny told Eric Berman, he said that young boy in that sailor suit in the middle of that photo is George Herbert Walker Bush. The former first president of the United States, he's sitting in a group photo as a 14 or 15-year-old boy, and he's surrounded in a room that includes Martin Bormann, Reinhard Galen, Otto Skorzeny, and Joseph Mengele. These are four of the top echelon players of the Third Reich. And if it's true, and photographically, at least to my eye, it certainly seems to look like George Bush, then we have a man who is evidently German-born, evidently in among a group of people who, at least in the 1930s, were very high up in the Nazi Party. And our 41st president of the United States is sitting in a room with these people. How can that be? Well, it can be if he was born in Germany, if he in fact was chosen to be a important player for the Third Reich, and he was infiltrated into the United States and made to appear to be U.S. born, U.S. schooled and raised, and appeared to be the son of Senator Prescott Bush. That's how it could be. And there's no other way, there is no other explanation. Because I'm certain that even though we were not at war with Germany in 37 or 38, we knew, the United States knew we were headed towards war. The people knew. They certainly knew who Hitler was. They certainly knew that he was building arms. He had remilitarized the Rhineland by 1935. He passed the Enabling Act. He was a known dictator. We knew war was coming. So I can't see any legitimate reason why Prescott Bush, his wife, and his son George Bush should be in a mountain lodge with major, major top echelon players of the Third Reich, other than that they are more than sympathizers, they are collaborators. They are infiltrators. They are Nazis. That's why they're in the photo. Because it's a photo of very high-ranking Nazis without the uniform, except for the German naval uniform George Bush is wearing and the German naval uniform that Martin Bormann's wearing. Now, why are they wearing the uniforms? I have no idea. I'm just going to guess they were probably in some sort of training function, and they were wearing the uniforms because they were just recently involved in some sort of training exercise, perhaps, and then wound up at that gathering. So, here we have a photo that, to my eye, and based on the testimony of Skorzeny to Eric Berman, he says, this guy, and this young man is your 41st president, George Bush. Now, sitting next to him and in front of him, I, you know, leapt to the conclusion that while the guy was referred to as George Scherf by Otto Skorzeny in his recount of this information to Eric Berman, in looking at the photo of Prescott Bush, I kept on going back and asking myself, this looks like Prescott Bush to me. I'm looking at it. I found this photo on the internet. It was dated March of 1949. And the original photo showed Prescott Bush, his wife, Dorothy Walker Bush, George Bush standing next to him. George Bush is holding is the president, the current president of the United States. Of course, he's a very young baby at the time. He's quite a baby. He's a young boy. He's a young toddler, And then beyond them is even a Barbara Bush. She, in the original photo that I found on the internet, included Barbara Bush. But I cropped the photo down so you only saw the three immediate members of George Bush's family. Prescott Bush, George Bush, of course, and his mother. Because I wanted you to see that picture side by side with the three individuals from the 1938 German Lodge photo. And when you just look at each of them, to me, the similarity in appearance is more than casual. It's remarkable, in my opinion.
Now, if I can interject something here, Ken, before I made those comparisons with those photos, I had one, besides this family group photo, I had one photo of George Scherf, and this was a photo that I had gotten via Eric Berman, and it was a special awards ceremony in New York. I think it was the Electrical Institute Associates of America, something like that, and Tesla was receiving an award from that group.
Right.
And George Scherf was standing off to the side in that photo. Now, as I did my research in this story, and I did the genealogical research on the Bush family, and I kept coming up with these dead ends. This can't be. In other words, what they're claiming can't be true because they conveniently put into the genealogy databases the information they want there, but there's no historical proof of any of these people even actually existing other than when they infiltrated into our history, if you get my meaning. So I kept making comparisons. Okay, George Scherf was dealing with Tesla, and here's written documentation, and where is Prescott Bush during this time? Prescott Bush is in Europe? No. Or he's in Europe was the excuse. You see, there was always a convenient out in the timeline for him to explain his whereabouts. And what I think is that possibly Tesla knew this and just never mentioned it to anyone. He was probably sharp enough to know that Prescott Bush and George Scherf were the same person. I came to that conclusion by an overwhelming preponderance of what at first appeared to be circumstantial evidence, but later I could corroborate. Even after the story, I continued coming up with information, and pretty damning information. For instance, when the Union Banking Corporation was put out of business temporarily for violating the Trading with the Enemy Act, and this was discovered in 1941, but they didn't close the bank down until 1942. All of a sudden, George Scherf disappears from the scene in terms of Tesla, other than a couple of unscheduled trips. And one of the trips had to do with a man that was buying a suit at a store, a high-end dry goods store in New York. Today we call those department stores. It was Arnold Constable on Fifth Avenue. And the only person who would have to be working there, Tesla still had a job. So Scherf would have been working with Tesla. However, at the time, there were some issues with the projects that Tesla was working on because we were getting close to the Philadelphia experiment. And Tesla decided he didn't want anything to do with that. Otto Skorzeny is in the picture at that time. And when I say in the picture, I mean he's on the scene here in the United States. There's a world war going on, and he described having been at the Philadelphia experiment with Reinhard Galen. So is that a coincidence that these two men are in this photo here with George Bush, George Scherf, okay, the Scherf family, and the Scherfs are with Tesla, and they come to steal the Utrons from the failed Philadelphia experiment. Right off the ship, they stole two of them. Mm-hmm. This is this is recounted by Skorzeny.
Yes.
And this is confirmed with another one of my guests, Jim Murray, who's a scientist who was weaned off of Nikola Tesla's research and knew many of the people that worked with Tesla. So Jim Murray mentioned the Utron. And how would Otto Skorzeny know about a Utron? How would he know about this sophisticated invention of Tesla's unless he had stolen it, like he said?
Yes.
And so when the bank was shut down, Prescott had to get a job. He had to support his family. He was noted for traveling on the train. He met Tesla on the train and would take Tesla picnic basket lunches quite often. When Tesla was working on Wardenclyffe, he would pick up the lunch at the Waldorf Astoria and deliver them via the train. Now, the gentleman from Long Island who bought several suits at Arnold Constable related a story having met the accountant of Nikola Tesla, and that would have been George Scherf. But George Scherf still had his job with Union Sulphur Company. He was employed by the Rockefellers. So Prescott would have had to have been the one selling the suit. And he's the one that took this man to see Nikola Tesla in 1943. They met at a beach, and they sat on something like a park bench at this beach. It had to have been Prescott Bush, who was also George H. Scherf, Sr. So I began putting all of this evidence together, and this story just clinched it for me, this account of this man. And the only reason he even went to that store was to save the local tax he would have paid if he had gone to their Long Island store. He had the stuff shipped to his house. And so he saved the tax because it was being taken out of the county, out of New York City. Very, very interesting story. And this occurred around Christmas time, right before Tesla's murder. Tesla was murdered within the next 2 weeks of that meeting. Very interesting piece of information.
Well, what I'd like to, for new listeners who are just hearing the story, the information related to George Scherf here in the United States and Tesla is another branch or arm of the story that is fascinating. There's also I have many questions in that regard. But what I think is important, though, because I think is the essence of what we're talking about here, is that apparently George Bush Sr., if this photo is accurate, was apparently born in Germany. Now, one could take another idea. It's possible that if the two other people in the photo are Prescott Bush and his wife Dorothy, I suppose one could imagine the possibility that they visited Germany at that time with their son, and pose for those photographs. It's a possibility, at least. It's just my musings. But it's another way to explain their presence there. However, the photo, though, is incriminating. So whether you want to believe George Bush is a German-born national, or you want to believe his birth records, which in your article, there are so many holes in the accuracy and authenticity of George Bush's birth records and schooling records in supposedly in the United States, that you can drive a Mack truck through it. And if people take the time to read your very lengthy article, they'll get the specifics of exactly what those holes are, because they've got this guy. There is no steady, consistent stream of information about where he was born and about where he went to school, etc. It's a real fudge job there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but still, if you're adamant that Bush could not have been born in Germany, but just based on the photo comparison, though, if you think, well, yeah, that does look like George Bush, and yeah, that does look like Prescott, what are they doing in the middle of that lodge with major players of the Third Reich?
Well, that's their house, first of all. I will tell you this, because there is a horseshoe pit picture with Otto Skorzeny and some of the other Scherf family. Scherf Bush, we'll say, for those that are wondering who the Scherf were. That's the alias. Bush is the alias, okay? The AKA is Bush.
Okay.
At the horseshoe pit. Now, there's another photo that I have. Eric Berman gave me this photo, which shows President Bush, 41st president, pitching horseshoes with Mikhail Gorbachev in the same horseshoe pit.
Yes. Yeah. I have them both, and I know the one you're talking about, but to my knowledge, that is the Bush estate here in the United States.
No, no, that's Germany. That's the one in Germany.
Oh, well, that's not my recollection then. I was pretty sure that, I'm trying to remember what state it was in. I thought it was New York.
No, it's the same one. Hasn't changed. That collection of photos were taken there at the German property, just south of Leipzig. And that has been pretty much confirmed.
Okay, well, now that's not my recollection, but I haven't looked at those pictures in a long time. I did want to bring up the horseshoe pitching photo with the young Skorzeny, with the young George Bush, and with Prescott Bush, the three of them standing in that photo, but I was pretty sure that was the Bush estate in New York, and then when they did the horseshoe pitching with Gorbachev many years later, it was from the same Bush residence. So
yeah,
this is news to me as far as a German location for that site.
That's Germany. And there are other photos that go with that show the farmhouse animals and sort of a fenced-in area which serves sort of like a corral. It's not a Western-looking corral, but where they had cows and sheep and horses. That was another thing. Some of the photos are with horses. Same general area.
Well, I think it's important for anyone who's looking at this story to realize that there were many, many important photos provided by Eric Berman. The lodge photo is important because it shows what we believe is George W. Bush and his family sitting among top Nazis in a get-together. However, what I haven't published yet, but I've seen, because I obtained them from Eric's CD, are pictures of Otto Skorzeny with Bush in many, many situations over a wide span of time, going from the 30s into, well, particularly as he was, Otto Skorzeny was essentially, I suppose, was accompanying George Bush, both in Germany and when he came to the United States. He was probably playing the role he was an older person, Skorzeny, so he had to be playing something of the role of a protector and go-between sort of fellow, I'm sure, because he's seen with him in these photos in both the U.S. and in Germany and in the 30s, and then you have this series of photos that were definitely taken in the United States because they give the location as being in New Jersey, in which you see young George Bush, you see Otto Skorzeny, you see the German film film documentary person, Lena Riefenstahl.
Mm-hmm.
You see a woman who were told is the mother of George Bush. I'm not sure if that's the case, but these were 1930-era photos taken here in America. I think the location was given as New Jersey. In all of the shots with Skorzeny, Skorzeny's so easy to recognize because, A, he's so tall, and the shape of his head and the color of his hair are very distinctive. You'd have a hard time missing Skorzeny, whether he's a young man or, you know, a much older man in his 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the pictures that he took, and he, among the group that he gave to Eric Berman, you see Skorzeny at weddings and, you know, other family-type get-togethers, holiday-type events in the 70s and 80s and 90s. You can't miss Skorzeny. He's just so obvious that even though he ages, of course, his body shape doesn't change that much, and his hair is still thick, right into old age. It's not hard to spot that man at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you see him repeatedly in these other photos taken here in America at family gatherings, including, you know, the Hannah Reich,
the pilot.
The pilot. She's in photos at, up to, I'm guessing at the date, up to 86 or 84, 85, 86. You see her in a wedding photo there. I think she passed away somewhere there in the late 80s. You see Martin Bormann in almost every one of these shots. You see Joseph Mengele in many of these shots. You see Walter Rauf in many of these shots. You see Alois Brunner in many of these shots. These are top men. Reinhard Gehlen. Reinhard Gehlen,
mm-hmm,
is in practically every family shot that Skorzeny had. And yet we're told that Martin Bormann died outside the Chancellery in 1945, and the CIA arranged for a very big splash in the newspapers. I think it was in the 80s, if I recall, in which they supposedly, because there were so many doubts about Bormann actually being dead, that they supposedly dug up his bones and, oh, yeah, we've done DNA and test, or not, excuse me, not DNA test, we've done absolute positive bone, you know, structure. These are his teeth. Oh, this, there's no doubt about it. This is Martin Bormann. And so, you know, everyone who had evidence to the contrary that Bormann was alive, he was operating. He was pulling a lot of strings. He was operating a very big venture, as it were. They just were, as they always do with their disinformation, anyone who does pop up with some genuine stuff, they just throw this contrived disinformation articles or investigations or, official pronunciations from official them. Oh, no, we... And same with Skorzeny's death. Skorzeny himself explained to Eric Berman that the CIA faked my death in 1975. And I just got a letter. I reposted this story on my current news page. I had sent it to Jeff Runtz a couple of days ago. He put it up on his website. So there's a lot of people now who are looking at that photo. In fact, I was very surprised to see that I got almost 200,000 hits on that on my webpage just yesterday alone, and a large number of those were hits to the very photo that we're talking about, the article and the photo. And I posted that in August of 2007. I had saw your April article in early May. That's when I started to look. I obtained Eric's CD somewhere there in May, and I started to look at those photos. in that CD, plus reading his information, which is quite extensive. He's really spent a lot of time
mm-hmm.
putting the story together. And then, of course, you and I went on the phone a number of times, and I put up something in late May because I discovered an entity that was in one of the photos of George Bush when he was aboard an aircraft carrier in 1944. And I put up an article about that because I thought it was extremely fascinating, this entity that sort of bled through in the photograph. Which, by the way, I just took off the internet. I didn't even, have the original. Eric Berman had the original, but he had scanned the photo and put it up on his website at the time. He had since taken that photo down. But anyway, I'm just playing in Photoshop. I'm enlarging the shot in Photoshop, and bingo, this entity shows up. So I wrote a little piece about it. But that's the process that got me to the point of looking more closely and enlarging these photos that Eric Berman provided. And I was able to improve the quality of Eric's photo, of the Lodge photo, by simply running it through a feature called Auto Level in Photoshop, which intensifies all the colors and makes everything just come up cleaner and brighter. And from there, I just started to enlarge and crop the photos so that I could just have the SHRFs centered in the photo. And then I compared them with this 1949 photo of the Prescott Bush family. Again, I just found it on the internet. And as I started to crop the pictures, they're about the same size, make the heads about the same size, I'm saying to myself, my God, these look like the same three people. And so from there, however, though, I went to other photos. The part one, actually, it must have been in June, was it? Maybe late May or June. I started to crop Martin Bormann's head out of each group photo that he was in from the Scorzani's shoebox. And I made all the heads the equal size. So I did this, I forget how many headshots I got there, maybe 15. I went on the internet, I found six or seven official photos that the Nazis had taken of Martin Bormann. And then I added an additional, 12 or so from the Scorzani collection of just Martin Bormann's head only. And there too, I think if you look at them, one by one, it seems to me, it's pretty evident to me, it's the same man. And the last shot you'll see on the Martin Bormann comparison shows him, it's dated, according to Eric Berman, the photo is dated 2003. And he, at the time, Martin Bormann was using the alias of Ed Kobelars. Now, you and I, because you've done some dowsing, you've also have some psychic investigative skills that I don't have, but you and I have talked about the notion that Joseph Mengele is still alive and living in this country, and you
mm-hmm.
you named the city and the state in a conversation with me not so long ago. I don't know if you want to reveal that here, but you told me exactly where he was, and I don't know for a fact, but if that last photo of Martin Bormann in 2003 is an indication of his energy, his robustness, his health, I'm going to have to guess that Bormann is still alive because he looks very strong and healthy. Of course, he looks like an older man, but he doesn't look frail. He looks like he's got a vigorous constitution. So 2003 was, only 5 years ago.
Yes, out of all of the people in that family photo that we're talking about,
yes,
Scorzani is gone.
Yes,
and we'll assume Prescott Bush, George H. Scherf Sr. is gone.
Okay.
Two of them. The rest of them are still alive.
Yeah, that's a very strong suspicion. Of course, the Hannah Reich woman died in Germany in the late 80s. I think Lena Riefenstahl died a few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. And she was in a few of those photos from the 30s, Scorzani's photos from the 30s. But the players, Reinhard Gehlen, I don't know his status today, or Alois Brunner, I don't know. Walter Rauf was having difficulty. I'm not sure he's still alive. But
well, there's one name we're not really mentioning a whole lot here, and that's the photo that Eric got from the Lake McDonald Lodge, August 18th, 1997. There was a reunion, and we came to learn that this man was living at Lake McDonald Lodge for around 30 years. He was well known there. And he ended up dying in Clinton, Maryland, at the Clinton Nursing Home. And his name was Adolf Hitler.
But he went by the name of?
William Coates.
Okay.
Now, what's interesting about his death, when this William Coates died, they were claiming he was the oldest man in the world, died at age 114. And they quickly got a genealogical evaluation done by a professor from a school, I think it was UCLA, either UCLA or USC, a gerontologist. Did this quick study and said the man could have only have been 92 years old, not 114. And they said that William Coates had no record of his birth. His family knew very little about him, but I think he had something like 37 grandchildren. And I mean, it was ridiculous how many people there were in the family, and they knew nothing of this man.
Yeah.
His so-called vocation was working on a tobacco farm and then working for the state of Maryland and the highway system, you know, like the Department of Transportation.
Yes.
Doing highway construction, which was a ruse. Now, there's a very interesting thing about William Coates. I found 8 William Coates born in Seat Pleasant, Maryland. This is where William Coates, the one whose name they borrowed, was born. Hitler was born April 20th, 1889, and this William Coates was born June 2nd, 1889. Okay? Now, that Coates died in 1931. Now, there were other Coates that died later on, and it doesn't matter which one they want to refer to or how they want to play the game. That was the guy whose name they took, the
okay.
one that was born in 1889.
Right.
And he died at the Clinton Nursing Home
mm-hmm.
in Clinton, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a preponderance of evidence, people saying that he lived at Lake McDonald Lodge, which is where Scorzani took these photos, and I was able to compare the photos with live shots, virtual shots on the website there. And it's very interesting. If you call the hotel, you get a man with a German accent that says, "Leave your name and the number, and we will call you back."
Mm-hmm.
A very dark kind of phone message. You know, you expect someone to say, "Hi, thank you for calling Lake McDonald
yes.
Lodge."
Right.
You know, something a little bit upbeat to.
Yeah.
No, this sounded like the Nuremberg trials. This
yes.
guy's voice. Okay. So it's a very, very interesting place there. We're talking about a private hotel on federal lands. This is a federal park. Very
yes.
interesting how the place is being run today. But
right.
this is how they've infiltrated our society, okay? And I'm not going to mince words on this. Now, people will say, oh, that's absolutely ridiculous. Well, we know that, that the dental records of the person they found in the bunker did not match Hitler's. Okay, it wasn't Hitler. Skorzeny describes how Hanna Reich flew him and Hitler to Austria and then on to Madrid, and later they made their way to Argentina, likely on a U-boat. Now, if you want to backtrack a second and wonder why Bormann and Scherf Jr. are wearing Navy suits, the photo you alluded to from 1944, taken with the two crew members who died when the plane was ditched in mid-flight, the reason this plane was crashed was so that they could get the gun, the Germans could get the gun and copy the gun on this ship. Had a special weapon that they wanted. And the plane could have even landed on the water. Instead, they crashed it and they towed it with a submarine, a German submarine. They had people waiting to pick George Bush up. And they picked him up, they picked the plane up, and they towed the plane to a cargo ship and then took it on to Germany. So you have somebody who was trained in naval exercises before he joined the U.S. Navy, before he was inserted into the U.S. Navy, much like the McCain family.
Yes.
Now, George Scherf Sr. shows up in 1913 and 1914 convicted in New Zealand. I found this. This is a needle in a haystack, if you remember this in my article. And it's critical because this is during a time when he should have been entering Yale University, and he's arrested, and he was given an 11 shilling fine or 2 days in jail for insubordination on a ship. And this particular ship, the Surrey, was a ship that was transporting soldiers from New Zealand to Australia, and it's very crucial to the history of the Bush family in the shipping industry. Very, very crucial to that. That was a needle in a haystack.
Well, let me also then just amplify and review about, it's important what you're bringing up, because a lot of people might find it difficult to believe that Hitler survived the war and he did not die in the bunker. But I first want to remind listeners that the photo you're referring to, taken in the lodge, shows Otto Skorzeny in the photo, but it also shows a partial view, a partial profile view of an older man who's in the same shot, in the same lodge, who Skorzeny told Bormann, this is Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that you dreamed up, or Bormann or I dreamed up. Skorzeny explained to Bormann, this is Adolf Hitler.
Yes, now, and the profile, the amount of the profile that shows in that shot, including the ear size and the ear angle, the position on the head, the whole nine yards, matches other photos of Hitler.
Right.
I've done plenty of comparisons on it.
Okay. So just to quickly, I had spent some time a few years ago, particularly in 2005, reading much more about the cover-up and the hoax of the Hitler so-called death in the bunker. And if you spend enough time reading all the books, the well-known books, there's an English writer by the name of Trevor Roper who did what was considered the definitive book. If you read all the so-called definitive books, and even ex-Nazis who wrote books in the 50s and so forth, they tend to pretty much sell the cover story that that Hitler was had shot himself supposedly in the forehead, and Eva Braun had taken poison. But if you really seriously look at the evidence, this is what really happened. Hitler and Eva Braun probably were spirited out of the bunker by Hannah Reich, as you said, in a helicopter, by the way, which they had at the time, and very small one, about 2 weeks before, you know, the person they claim was Hitler was found. So about mid-April, because, you know, the Russians arrived at the German chancellery about, I think, May 1 or 2 of 1945. And Hitler's suicide supposedly had taken place just a day or so earlier, on April 30th. Well, the man who was shot was probably his driver, who I understand was his cousin. And the verbal account we get of Hitler is that he put this, maybe it was a Walter PPK, up to his right temple and fired. At least that's the verbal account. When you read the account, or you've seen movies, they'll show you him pointing the revolver to the right side of his temple. There was a body recovered. The body recovered, obviously, by the Russians. The Russians arrived at the chancellery first, before the Americans did, at the bunker. The body that they found, which was buried in a shallow grave, was not burned at all. Let me repeat that. When the Russians found the grave of the man that they were assumed was Hitler, who was, by the way, alone in the grave, there was no woman found in the grave next to Hitler. His body was not burned. I'll repeat that a third time. His body was not burned. There was, so, and they took a picture of him with a card on his chest that said Adolf Hitler, and he has a hole dead in the center of his forehead between his eyes. Mm-hmm. Dead in the center. The person who was shot. I have a copy of the photo. It's in a couple books. It might be on the internet. What the Russians did is that they quickly realized this was not the real Hitler, and they reported that to Stalin. And Stalin, in turn, had passed that information on to both Roosevelt and Churchill and other military figures at the Yalta Conference, because they were asking him, because they, you know, they knew that he had first opportunity. He said, no, he said, this Hitler escaped. He told Roosevelt and Churchill that he had escaped to Spain. What the Russians did in those first few days, though, however, is that before they got other orders from Moscow, the Russians burned the body. And that when they shipped this body back to Russia, it was a burned body, which the Russians themselves had torched. So there was no conflagration in the garden with, I forget the name of the two players who claimed to be looking on. I can't remember now. Two top Nazis claimed to have doused the gasoline on both bodies, Eva Braun and Hitler. All contrived. None of it happened that way. Totally made up. And there was a number of graves that were in that back area. For instance, who did kill himself, though, was Joseph Goebbels, his wife, and his children. They committed suicide a day or two or three before. I can't remember exactly the timing, but it was near the end of April. They committed suicide. And their bodies were burned and buried in that rear garden area there. But there was other bodies. A lot of Nazis, high-end Nazis who were either coming to the bunker or staying in the bunker, they wind up getting killed for various reasons, and they have nowhere else to put the bodies, so they're burying them in that garden area there, behind the chancery there. So there was a number of bodies there, but the most important body, that of Adolf Hitler, first was not Hitler, And number two, the body was not burned. There was no female body found with the so-called Hitler body. The Russians burned the body and then sent that corpse to Russia for forensic examination. As far as I know, the remains are still in Russia. Now, I've talked to Arizona Wilder. She was featured in David Icke's 1999 book, The Biggest Secret.
Mm-hmm.
As a child, she was mind-controlled and subjected to trauma-based mind control all of her life. But part of her, quote, training, her horrific abuse that she had suffered, took place on the China Lake Naval Station here in Southern California. There's underground bases under hundreds of military bases around this country. And China Lake has one of the larger underground bases. And she told me, she reported in the book to David Icke, but we had long conversations about this. She met, in 1969, she met Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun in the underground complex under China Lake. And she told me very, with great detail, how Hitler had a small boy in front of him, standing in front of him. He's sort of being fatherly and sort of avuncular to this boy, very seemingly to be very nice to him and, you know, cajoling him and so forth. Maybe a boy of 5, 6, 7 years old, something like that. And Hitler was hiding behind his back a severed human left hand. And that at a certain point in this encounter with this young boy, he takes the left hand and puts it, you know, he taps him on it. And now naturally, this terrifies this little boy. Because you know he can see it's a human hand that's been cut off. It's got you know blood sinew dripping from it, etc. So she described that to me very in great detail, and that how Eva during all this was completely nonplussed by any of this. It's as if he was playing ball with the boy. She had no reaction at all. It was just something very ordinary, commonplace, and so forth. And boy, that was very chilling to hear that story. That's one source, a direct source that I got from someone who saw Hitler. The second source is I've talked to Cisco Wheeler, a woman who used to be an Illuminati programmer, co-wrote two or three books with Fritz Springmeier, very important books, The Illuminati Formula for a Mind Control Slave, and others. And she had told me that her father had worked with Joseph Mengele for many years as a programmer, and that they had often visited Adolf Hitler at a home that he owned in Oregon, and that she had a photo that her father had given to her on her father's deathbed. He passed this envelope to her, and he said, "You know, keep this. You'll want to keep this. You might need it in the future." And it shows Adolf Hitler, Joseph Mengele, and Cisco Wheeler's father practically arm in arm on the front porch of this Oregon home that, according to Cisco, Hitler lived in for many years, maybe 12 or 15 years. Now, I don't know if he lived there exclusively. My guess is he was moving around from different mm-hmm. locations, not only in this country, but in other parts of the world. Because I also talked to another gal who was a victim of Project Monarch mind control, and she told me of her incidents of meeting Hitler and Eva Braun. Well, she met Eva Braun also in Canada, but she told me that Hitler and Mengele she had met on a number of occasions when she was a younger woman in Australia and New Zealand. So I've talked to at least three people that had first-hand knowledge of seeing and interacting with Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun.
Now, do you know if that was Ashland, Oregon, by any chance?
You know, I can't remember, but I did take notes with Cisco, and I talk to Cisco once in a while. That particular conversation with her took place, might have been as many as long as 4 years ago. We had two marathon sessions on the phone. We talked one night, started out as a very, what I thought was going to be a short, pleasant little exchange, and then as we started to exchange information, that grew into a five-hour marathon. And then the very next day, she called again, and we went at it for 6 hours. And I mean, she told me incredible things. I took very detailed notes. I have notebooks filled with the notes that I took during those phone conversations. Mm-hmm. A great deal of important information, which I will write about on my website. I have much to mm-hmm. expand on. And Cisco Wheel is very much alive and kicking and is ready to talk. So
there were some pretty wild stories that Scorzani alluded to in regard to Mengele. Now,
yes.
We know from various people that have seen him that he goes by the name Dr. Green or Dr. Greenbaum.
Yes.
And you can compare that to information that you've gotten.
Yes.
Although Otto Scorzani specifically said that his alias is Stephen Rabel.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
And I can guarantee you that Stephen Rabel is trackable. Let's put
right.
it that way. Scorzani attributed the Zodiac murders in San Francisco to him. And the police knew that, but the police were ordered not to investigate because...
Yes, so just to be clear,
yeah.
Scorzani told Eric Berman that the Zodiac murders were committed by Joseph Mengele. Is that the clarification?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And Joseph Mengele, at least in the last few years, had been using the alias of Stephen Rabel.
Rabel.
Rabel, okay.
Yes.
And during his years in which he was very actively involved in mind control programming development projects, he was known by the victims particularly, and people who worked with him, by the name of Dr. Green or Greenbaum.
And what, yes.
What I might add to that is what Cisco told me is that many of them, like Ewan Cameron, who was another player from Canada, and other... mind control programmers, they had names of colors. I think her father, I could be wrong, was either Dr. White or Dr. Black. I can't remember. And the other color belonged to Ewan Cameron from Canada. So she said they had a whole series of colors assigned mm-hmm. to these guys. So, yes, continue then.
Well, I just find it interesting that this information connects together. You see, when you compare the information, when you compare research, when you compare the things that you find out from eyewitnesses, especially the ones that are in these mind control programs. I can tell you also that I suspected, and it was confirmed, again, by Scorzani, that they were very much into... let's say DNA modification. They understood and knew how to reverse the aging process, and so they were they had methods of appearing to be much younger than they were.
Yes, that's a good point that we need to amplify, because again, the listener who's grounded in conventional education is unaware of how many developments took place in secrecy in the last 70, 80 years or so that the general public, for the most part, does not know about and is unaware of. And one of them is that the Nazis, Hitler and his cohorts, have been working with a certain alien group since the early 1930s. Now, according to Al Bielek, this alien group had approached the United States, had approached President Roosevelt about sharing technology, etc. But Roosevelt's military advisors had cautioned him not to get into an arrangement because their presumption was that the aliens were really interested in figuring out the defense capabilities of the U.S. military and then would use that information strategically to defeat us militarily. Now, that's what his advisors supposedly told Roosevelt. So Roosevelt refused the invitation from this particular alien group, and I'm told by Al Bielek that they then turned to Hitler, who welcomed them with open arms. And from that encounter, they acquired much advanced alien technology. Now, part of that technology was anti-gravity spacecraft. The Germans were developing them from Germans and Austrians who already demonstrated ability in this area. Victor Schauberger, for one, was developing a saucer design, not willingly, he was forced to, for Hitler, based on implosion using air. But they were copying or getting clues as to how to make drive systems, etc., from aliens, as well as the Germans have a reputation for a fine scientific mind, and they were making many high-velocity spinning discs that cancel out gravity when you get to the when you get the speed up high enough, you cancel out gravity. So they had many, many models. I was just reviewing a videotape that I had acquired from the Dowsers meeting many years ago. I presume he's still alive. There's a man here in California whose name is Vladimir Terzisky, and he had done interviews with Al Bielek in the early 90s. I got a hold of his videotapes. Very well done. But he also was working on exposing the variety and number and the extent of German so-called flying saucer development, which is very extensive.
I have many of those pictures, Michael, on my website, too.
Right. There's some of those advanced craft, the Hannibal, et cetera, are on your website. I know Michael Anthony, another guest of yours, is apparently a buff in this area. I need to compare notes with him sometime. But the Vladimir Terzisky information was really very thorough. This guy really spent a lot of time, and this was in the early 90s. This videotape was made around 1992 or 93. He really, really was on top of the information.
Well, another key to this whole thing, again, goes back to Tesla. Now, Tesla was known, and I learned much of this from Jim Murray.
Yep.
He was under the tutelage of Gene Carini. Okay, Gene Carini was a hands-on lab assistant with Tesla, and Gene took Jim Murray under his wing as a young man. Later, Jim traveled to Michigan, and a guy by the name of Warren Goetz was building a ship. I have a couple of pictures of that on my website, in my Jim Murray photo album. So Tesla was writing and researching and doing experimentation, but basically all he had to do was draw a picture and just go ahead and build this. They chose to take the technology and use it to cloak a ship, which is where the Philadelphia experiment came into being. Now, if you look at the picture of the family photo again, the two people, according to Skorzeny, who murdered Tesla, and keep in mind, he said that the sheriffs were trained to spy on Tesla, steal his inventions, and get them over to the Germans. That was their purpose initially, okay? So you're talking about Prescott and George H.W. Bush on the American side, or George H. Scherf Sr. and Jr. Now, is it a coincidence that George Scherf worked with Tesla and these two other men in this photo were involved in the murder, as well as the stealing of Tesla's neutrons from the Philadelphia experiment. There were three. They could only carry two of them. According to Skorzeny, they weighed about 80 pounds each.
Yes.
So they each took one, and they got them back to Germany. This is in 1943.
Yes.
While the war is going on.
Yes.
Okay, now, also consider the fact that at the end of the war, when they formed the CIA, Galen was in line. He formed the Galen organization, and he was anticipating being the head of Interpol. I don't know whether or not that happened, but he was both working for the Russians and the Americans, and they were paying him. The United States was paying him exorbitant amounts of money for so-called intelligence as to what the Russians were doing. He was playing both sides of the fence, collecting a paycheck from the Russians and the United States. And they didn't even check to see if the information was valid. They just presumed because of who he was that it was.
Hmm.
So you had another war going on after the war, only it's an intelligence war. And the same people are involved in the center, just like today. There's no difference today with what's going on and what went on in two world wars and all the time in between. Well, ultimately, the bankers were the ones that made the money, and they were all involved. The Bush family was involved in the banks, Union Banking Corporation, and they're involved in the bank scandals today.
Yes. Yes. And,
go ahead.
And also, just a very quick sidebar about McCain. People need to remember that the so-called Keating's Five, which involved a scandal, Charles Keating. McCain was one of the Keating Five.
Mm-hmm.
And if we get information from mainstream media in a sort of high-speed, fragmented way in which the media never connect the dots for us. They'll never go back. But if we, who are interested in finding out the truth of the matter, take the time, we realize that find out a great deal of information just, you know, from the comfort of our home, working with a computer and with books, and just, you know, putting two and two together. It's not hard to do, and there are a lot of people who attempt to dissuade you or to vilify you for doing this work or to disparage you in some ways, but that's usually a case of the closer you get to the truth, the hotter it gets for the participants, so they crank up the, you know, their legions of shills out there to try to throw flack up at you to get you to quiet down. And I'm sort of seeing that with some of the email I'm getting from this reposting of this lodge photo. I didn't get nearly as much flack from certain readers as I am now, but it's getting much more coverage now. And the conventional information that we're told in history books, etc., when it's convenient to the agenda of the elites, deaths are contrived. It's not hard to do that. The CIA is in that business. It's real easy to do. And they certainly did in the case of Otto Skorzeny in 75. Al Bielek mentions that one of the key scientists during the Philadelphia experiment in 1943 was a man named Dr. John von Neumann. The CIA faked his death in 1958. Von Neumann actually died, I think it was 4 years ago. He was in a nursing home, either in upstate New York or just over the Canada border, I can't remember. But it was convenient and necessary to make him, as you said, a spook. So they kill him off in documentation only, and then they continue to function in some clandestine way, so that now they don't have to answer to reporters or to writers, etc., because, quote, the person involved has been declared dead. So they arrange a lot of genuine suicides of innocent people and call them, they arrange a lot of murders and call them suicides, but they also fake a lot of deaths. And the people are very much alive.
Yeah, and there's never a proper autopsy, and usually it ends in cremation.
Yeah, that's always the case, and particularly with people they murder, they want to eliminate any possibility of evidence, so they'll go ahead and cremate the body, even without the relative's knowledge or permission. That's been done again and again. That CIA fellow, what's his name, Frank? Oh, the CIA pushed him out of a window. He was involved in LSD, well, so-called LSD experiments, but he started to realize just how dark and horrendous the CIA was abusing people in mind control experiments, and I think he wanted out of the CIA, and there ain't no getting out of the CIA, so they just had it. They tanked him up on LSD and pushed him out a window. We all know that the Admiral, what's his name, in 1948 or so, what's that Admiral's name? He was pushed out of a window, too.
Secretary of Defense James Forrestal.
That's what I'm talking about. That was not a jump on his part. That was a push. And they get rid of people who either get too close to the truth or are inclined to reveal the truth, as in the case of Forrestal's case. But they set you up first for the mental routine in order to get you into an institution.
And isn't it interesting that John McCain III, we're talking about the senator now, was on the USS Forrestal?
Yes.
When he did his wet start.
Yes, and killed the pilot behind him, and I think ultimately 164 men died from the fires that ensued because of that hotshot who couldn't do better than graduating fifth from the bottom of a class of out of 900 students. It's going to be swell if we got this guy with his finger on the nuke option. Oh yeah.
Well, Ken, we're out of time.
Yes, and we've ruined another perfectly good hour together.
It's been
quote
interesting.
A couple of other guys on the radio.
Actually, we're going to have you back again next week. So,
yes,
for the listening audience, Ken will be back, I think, next Tuesday. And
yes, we'll probably be launching into another one of our fascinating discussions about other areas that we've been looking into, but I thought it was wise tonight to at least discuss the Skorzeny photos, because this is a story that needs to get out, and people need to understand that it's easy for people in charge to obfuscate history, to make it appear to the casual reader, to the casual observer, to the casual research, that everything in the history books is the way it actually happened. But you've got to realize that that's not the way the real world is working. We have very clever people who never really lost the Second World War, in name only. And they've infiltrated the United States, the government, the military. And that's why we're following this fascist model in the loss of our constitutional guarantees. We're following the 1930s loss of the Weimar Republic with the same sort of shenanigans. The Reichstag fire led to the enabling laws. Well, it was an inside job, and if anyone is invested enough time in studying 9/11, you can clearly figure out that it was an inside job, and that led to the Patriot Act. They're following the Nazi model because we've had Nazis infiltrated into our country, here Bush being the at the top of that list, in order to destroy this country and to turn it into a fascist police state.
I don't know if you're aware, Ken, in the last couple of days, within the last couple of days, Michael Reagan on his radio show was quoted as having offered to pay for the bullets that kill anyone who is outspoken about the government's involvement in 9/11.
I read that. And I also read a counterattack by Devi Kidd, who isn't necessarily on my highest list of admirable people on the Internet, but nevertheless, she does say many things that I concur with. She said that he ought to be indicted and arrested for making death threats, which he should be.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, and you haven't heard a lick of this on the mainstream media, have you?
Not a word. Not a word.
Not a word. So maybe within the next week we'll have more on that. Maybe we can discuss that a little bit.
Yes.
Because he singled out Mark Dice by name, in fact. And
yes.
Mark has been on a number of talk shows in the last couple of days. And, of course, he's furious that somebody gets away with this. You had Don Imus losing his job with MSNBC over some comments about the ladies' basketball team. I think it was at Rutgers, was it?
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But it was, you know, there's no justification for that.
You have someone actually uttering...
making an out-and-out serious death threat on national radio, and not a thing is said about it. Right. Absolutely right. I mean, we live in Orwellian times.
Yes. Well, we are out of time right now, Orwellian or not. So thanks a lot. I'm looking forward to the next show, we'll continue this discussion and branch off into just about anything you'd like to talk about. And I want to thank you for setting the extra time aside for us tonight.
Okay, well, I thank you too, Don, and I hope we continue to be able to have these discussions, because it's very enlightening for me as well.
Okay, and for the listeners out there, thank you for listening in. Our guest tonight has been Ken Adachi. You can visit his website at educate-yourself.org or educate-yourself.org. And there's tons of all kinds of great journalistic research and investigative research, science, things on health, and just about any topic you can imagine. Ken is out there, kind of like me. And also I have some of his articles are posted either on my news page or in my archives page at directlightproductions.com. So I urge you to take a look at his work. He's known throughout the world. And I want to thank Don Newsom, Seth Hendrick, and Marcella for the sound. In the meantime, we'll be back again tomorrow night. Got another great show for you. Thanks for listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I'm Don Nikoloff. I wish you peace, love, and light, and have a good night.
exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.